The following programming is sponsored by the Museum of Sports. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Athletes should have the right to benefit from their own image and likeness in their name. As a matter of fact, they should actually own it, and that no one has the right to take it from you and make money off of it without actually negotiating it.
One of us is a walking museum of sports, from that first ball game with your folks to maybe getting that nervous, sweaty autograph, or maybe even taking your own kids to their first game. It's the feeling we all get that brings us all back to our own personal Philly Field of Dreams. And the Museum of Sports show is on the air and ready to go there with you. I'm Doug Scheinmel. Our show dedicated to sports memories, memorabilia, and the museum that's going to capture it all right here in Philadelphia. We're also live on the Talk 860 and Museum of Sports Facebook pages, and today is a very visual show in our second segment, so you may want to check us out on the Facebook pages at Talk 860 and Museum of Sports. Museum of Sports show brought to you by the Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialist in non-invasive treatment. Joining me, as always, from his sports cave in Villanova, he is our guide and our mentor, my illegitimate father, founder of the Museum of Sports, legendary Comcast Spectacor executive, and author of the new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lou Scheinfeld.
Well, thank you, and glad to be on Zoom with you to see everybody. I'm very excited about today's show, especially with the Bill Bradshaw, my good buddy, going to be on today and try and explain why kids in junior high are going to get paid for playing sports. So I wasn't good enough to get paid ever for maybe anything. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
And from her sweltering a sports room in South Jersey, the Museum of Sports Director of Community Outreach, Ms. Susan Baxter. Hi, Susan.
Hello, guys. I'm in the air conditioning, so it's all good.
Oh,
and
good.
I'm anxious for our second guest also, speaking about the old time Philadelphia good times, as we were talking before the show about JFK Stadium and how historic it was. It's a shame the city couldn't keep it here, but things happen. So,
yeah. Memories are short. Well, coming up today, his grandfather was Philly's legendary live sports and entertainment promoter for the first half of the 20th century. Pete Tyrell's grandson, Preston Tyrell, is going to be here with some amazing stories, photos, and home movies. So that's why you want to check us out on Facebook Live. And we've also got what's hot and what's not in the sports memorabilia market with our own king of sports collectibles, Mr. Nick Depatche Jr., with the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection. But up first, he knows college sports from the inside out as a baseball player at LaSalle and later becoming athletic director both there and at Temple University. Welcome back to Temple Hall of Famer, Mr. Bill Bradshaw. Hiya, Bill.
Doug, good afternoon. So good to be on with you, Susan, and Lou.
Yeah, we missed you last week. You were out in the golf course. I know you were trying to get in, or we were trying to get you in, and you probably just said, oh, to hell with it, and you went to the 19th hole.
And my punishment was to be darkened today so that my ugly face wouldn't ruin the three of you.
Yeah, you're either a Bond villain, a hostage, or an FBI informant. We're trying to figure out which one of those you are. But, Bill, you know, You heard in that opening clip, and he was a former athlete who's now sort of, it's ironic, he's advocating both the pros and the cons of NIL, name, image, and likeness. And that movement, it almost seems on the verge of approval by Pennsylvania's high school sports governing body, the PIAA, and it may have been passed since we spoke last week. I don't think they've reconvened yet. But it's obviously a trickle down from college athletes recently be able to cash in on their NILs. I mean, how far back do you remember the whole name, image, and likeness movement going? I mean, was that something that was ever on the radar going back to your days of moving into the front offices?
It really wasn't, Doug. It's a sort of a phenomenon of the last 2 years. You didn't even hear much rumors about this being as official as it's going to be. And believe me, we're at the tip of the iceberg with this. There isn't any guidelines. The NCAA right now is in limbo. I would not be surprised to see the NCAA as it's known now to go away, or some drastically reformed semblance of the NCAA.
Really?
So we don't even know all the rules and regulations and the guidelines. So it's the Wild West. It's really anything goes right now. So there's a lot of concern. And I was at the Athletic Directors Convention in June as a retired AD. And there wasn't even a rumor in Los Angeles of UCLA and Southern Cal leaving. And their athletic directors were there and the commissioners were there. 6,500 people in Las Vegas for 4 days. And not one rumor, not one conversation about it. But NIL was certainly front and center. And everyone was worried about how the NIL, name, image, and likeness, was going to impact our industry, and rightfully so. And now all of a sudden we have something that's at least as important to all the athletic directors in the NCAA.
And what was the big concern? What was the top of mind worry or paranoia about this at the administrative level? Is it the just plain and simple loss of revenue that what was exclusively the domain of these schools is now going to in some way be sort of cleaved off via, you know, a new layer of agents that are going to represent these kids? I mean, what is it that was kind of scaring everybody?
Not as much that, Doug, as you would think.
Yeah.
Although it's part of the conversation of the top five things to worry about, that it's going to dilute the revenue.
Pretty good one.
it was more of who was going to survive through all this. Who is going to be able to pay? And if we've got sponsors and we have sneaker organizations like Under Armour and Nike and Adidas, and we've got other entities out there who'd love to buy players for their institutions, when you have all of that in society lurking about wanting to get involved in paying athletes, that was mostly the conversation. How are we going to curb this? How are we going to control this?
Yeah, and Lou, we were talking last week. You know, I sort of half tongue-in-cheekingly said, gee, you know, NCAA going to name, image, and likeness sort of system, you know, that doesn't have corruption written all over it. And now that there's talk of the PIAA in Pennsylvania sort of opening that door at the high school level, I mean, it just sounds like it's got all sorts of graft and corruption potential.
Well, there's wealthy alumni groups at some of these schools, Oregon and Texas, Alabama, and I don't want to use the word they're buying players, but they're buying players.
Yeah.
I mean, and like Bill says, there's no rules and regulations. It is Wild West. But what scares me is it get down to the kids in high school, and these kids are susceptible to suggestion, pressure in their neighborhood. Peers, gangs, whatever.
Family.
Family. The family wants the money. And it's just crazy.
Well, Lou, throw in the gambling part of this. And obviously we were out in Las Vegas at the time. When you throw that into the equation, which means anyone can bet on any intercollegiate game anytime they want. Well, there's uncles and grandfathers and cousins and everyone who want to get into that act, especially if a young man feels he's underpaid by the NIL. Can you imagine that kind of rationale? That's why I did that, and that's why I shaved points, but I didn't throw the game. And I only did it for $25,000.
Yeah.
But Bill, I understand you're going to be on a committee to figure all this out. Is that right?
Well, there's nobody running to that committee, Lou.
Is it really? I mean, is it? It's something that nobody really wants to have their fingerprints on, because is it kind of a lose-lose for the NCAA and a lose-lose for all of these state, you know, interscholastic athletic associations? I mean, as you say, is it almost the beginning of their own extinction?
No question about it, Doug. And when you throw this into all the other things, calling it a perfect storm with the leagues and the major schools reorganizing and leagues getting bigger. And when you look at all that and throw the NIL in there, it's going to be the rich get richer for sure. No. Even now, every institution that I know of is rumored to be talking to the Big Ten and the SEC about getting in there. Well, when you throw the NIL and the payment of players in there, and at the high school level you have that, it's blurring the lines between professional sports clearly and everyone else. But it's going to be tough on the fans, because at some point they're going to say, well, why do I even bother watching intercollegiate athletics? Mm-hmm. You know, when we've got the high school kids getting paid, players staying 1 year and getting out and all of that. So it's really caused maybe the biggest concerns we've ever had at one time in intercollegiate athletics.
Well, who's going to fix it or straighten it out or regulate it? Is it Congress going to come up with something, or who is there?
Well, yeah, particularly if there's a reluctance on the part of the NCAAs and state interscholastic associations. I don't know.
Well, we're hiring a new CFO or whatever, CEO for NCAA as we speak. They're saying it's going to take 1 or 2 years to pick Emmert's successor, and that's going to have a lot to do with it. But the questions still are, no matter who it is, Moses or Abraham or whoever we find to do that, the question's going to be, who's going to run things? Congress? They're running away from this pretty much. They stirred it up, but they're running away from it. Is it going to be the presidents? And they've shown with the NCAA how reluctant the presidents are to get involved, certainly not the ADs. So who is going to control all of this when it's put together?
The new layer of agents. The new layer of every agency right now is probably adding in their NIL experts and reps. And they'll form an association, Bill, and then all hell will break loose.
Let's talk about the other 800-pound elephant, the teams jumping conferences, and the Big Five is going to be the Big Three or the Big Two or whatever. And as an aside, me being a former Temple guy and Temple rooter, where will Temple wind up, or where – should they wind up? What would be the best scenario for them?
Unfortunately, the football program is in the valley a little bit from where it's been in the last 10 or 15 years. But before that, they were even in worse shape. So it's not going to take much for Temple to get that back. The one ace that Temple has, Lou, is one that you really inherit, and that's your market. If you look at the Philadelphia, South Jersey, Delaware area market, you've got Rutgers to the north, and you've got Maryland, who's in the Big Ten to the south. So a place like the ACC, who's really truer to geography than most of the other conferences, you're looking right in the middle of their footprint, and you see Philadelphia. So that's what I would play if I was Temple, would be that card. That look at the TV sets we have, and I know that helped the Big Ten bring Rutgers in. And they associated Rutgers with New York and the TV sets that were there. It was much easier for them to accept a football program, an athletic program that wasn't that successful. So I think that's where Temple's big argument could be, and maybe Comcast could help them get into that conversation.
That's interesting. Yeah, simply because the flagship station is here. You know, the headquarters is here. It's no longer Rockefeller Center. And that's an excellent point. Is it strictly on television households, though? Are there other factors that sort of feather into that, Bill?
Well, there's an academic part of it. And Temple's mission has always been for the common person, the Philadelphia area family, maybe first-generation college kids. Does a great job academically. Temple's improving all the time. My daughter's a graduate. Of course, I was there for years and have watched that happen. So there's a lot of things academically Temple brings. It's one of the largest institutions in the country, you know, now 37,000 students. So there are a lot of things there. It's Philadelphia. Unfortunately, basketball doesn't have the same place and priorities for these schools as football does. And certainly Villanova has maximized, which I call Philadelphia, the capital of intercollegiate basketball in the world, is Philadelphia with the Big Five. So it's going to take more than that, but I think the market part of it, Doug, gives Temple a leg up in that conversation.
And Temple, if they could beef up their program and not but let it be like it was when they were in the Big East years ago and they got demolished, and they could bring in rivalries, Pitt, Syracuse, and the glamour teams like North Carolina and others, Duke, whoever, to bring some people into Awaken Financial field. Because right now, you know, if they get 20,000, I don't know how many of that is paid, in a 60, 70,000 seat stadium, it just doesn't look good for the league, for television. There's not much money coming in. So if they get rivalries and they get glamour teams coming in and they beef up their program, and I know that's a lot to ask, but that could be the answer.
And when you think, Lou, that not just a few short years ago when we brought Penn State into play in Notre Dame, they were sellouts. You couldn't get a ticket. Yep. So if you put Temple into that conference, it's going to bring in Clemson. It's going to bring in Florida State.
Yep.
And programs like that, you can see that Philadelphia might embrace it. It's the one thing Philadelphia hasn't really embraced, which is college football. And that's all been on Temple, and it will be on Temple unless Villanova suddenly decided they wanted to get into the major football business.
And is there a real danger, Bill, at some point, if there's enough migration of schools in and out of these conferences, that some of the less desirable conferences will just, you know, dry up and go away?
Yes, I think you're onto something there, Doug. There's no question that the NIL, together with all of the shifting in the conferences, is going to cause many programs to wonder if they should spend the money they do. So many of the mid-major type programs and conferences might say, why are we doing this? I mean, they're talking about going to 16 bids for the football championship. Ohio State is in the front of that. And the SEC certainly would like that to happen because they'd love to see six or seven other teams in the national football playoff. That's billions of dollars. So when they're doing all this, you can see how the programs that are in the mid-major or lower major are going to have to wonder, should we be in this big-time football business and lose all the money we're losing every year?
And would you end up having schools then, let's say, for the ones who aren't as desirable for other mid and larger conferences, either just playing independently, having to sort of piecemeal together a season schedule because there aren't enough folks for their old conference because they all left?
Yes, I believe those kind of conferences, if they're not going on in the athletic department or going on at the board of trustee and presidential level at many schools that we might be surprised at, that have looked at a series of years where they've had deficits, things are tightening up, people are questioning the value of a college education, and I don't agree with that, but they do, and all the thing about loans, all of those conversations I believe are going on now in places that say, shouldn't we get out of this rat race? Shouldn't we just get out, not pay athletes? Let's do it like Division III does it, without scholarships. So I believe that's going on now. I think all bets are off for everyone in Division I.
Is there an upside to that sort of thing happening, or are we looking at like a slow slide toward hell?
I wish there was a positive to this. And that's the question you have to ask. And I just happen to think with this new football playoff, the March Madness in basketball, there's not a better event in my view than that March Madness. And all of that's in jeopardy here with all of these moves and shifts and conferences going to 16. You know, the major priorities of the big time conferences are one, money, the green, two, power, and three, sustained dominance. So there's no question the SEC and the Big Ten right now are the two big dogs, and they're looking to dominate in college football and basketball for a long time. So where do you fit in that if you're a Temple? Where do you fit in that if you're a Villanova or LaSalle? Or
I get lost in it.
Yeah. Are you going to have a basketball championship that has the glamour and glitter of the one in March where everybody – no matter what their commitment is or level, have an opportunity to participate in it? You look at a St. Peter's last year, and that's what made it great for me to see the have-nots and the people who you know, there's nobody in America that's not pulling for those schools to go all the way. Everybody was all excited about that, and I think we're going to lose that.
Well, my biggest thing last week when we were discussing this topic was, you know, you take away – you know, you look at it from a player perspective, you're taking the fun out of the game. Like now it's all the money, the green and the greed, right? So why can't the players play for the fun of the sport? you know, the passion of it. And it takes all of that away because now they've got this weight on their shoulders that they have to perform because of the money, not because they're having a good time, not because they have to work as a team. So that's disheartening if this even happens.
It's a great point, Susan. And along with that, having fun and enjoying it would be the enjoyment of the fans, the mm-hmm. people who are going out to the games and watching you play. I would, no one's polled them. I haven't seen any statistics about that. As all these things are being committed to, the NIL, the conferences, nobody said to the fan, how do you feel about this? And I think if you're in the major league and the big part of this, all of this shifting, you're happy with it. And the only things that remain now is what's Notre Dame going to do? That's the exactly. hot topic now. What's Bill. Oregon going to do? What's our guy with Nike going to do out there and University of Washington? Those are the ones that are left.
Bill, when you're out playing golf, does your mind wander and you say to yourself, darn, I wish I was back in that chair behind the desk handling all this stuff? Or would you rather play golf?
Hell no.
I would say this, Lou, to cut to the quick of that, I get invited to more outings now and lose less golf balls than I used to when the ball was teed up and I'm thinking, what the hell league are we going to be in next year? Or how we pay these athletes. So the ball's ending up on the fairway a little more often.
Nothing like the wandering mind of a retired man on a fairway. Temple Hall of Famer, Bill Bradshaw, as always, we love having you on the Museum of Sports Show. Come back when you figured out a solution to name, image, and likeness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks,
Take
Bill.
Care, Bill. Good
hey,
seeing you.
Hey, love you guys. Thank you very much. Honored to be on.
Hey, we want to make sure our viewers and listeners go to themuseumofsports.org to make a tax-deductible contribution today, or better yet, buy a copy of Lou's new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit the Museum of Sports, and you can be part of Philly Sports Shrine today. When we come back, Philly's iconic sports and entertainment promoter's grandson, when the Museum of Sports show continues right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. We'll be right back.
It was 1967, and Philadelphia was in a rut. The economy, riots, Vietnam. That is, until the Broad Street Bullies rallied the region's spirits and brought more than 2 million into the streets to celebrate. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's candid memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You'll love the inside stories about Frank Sinatra, Ed Snyder, Bernie Parent, Frank Rizzo, Elvis Presley, the 76ers, Mick Jagger, Electric Factory Concerts, and Kate Smith. And you'll find out how Lou Scheinfeld helped Ed Snyder rescue the Flyers and, against all odds, got the Spectrum built. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed first edition copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. The book the Philadelphia Inquirer called a fascinating and hilarious read. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. An ode to a building that truly rocked. The Museum of Sports show is presented by Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Depatche is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat heart disease, hypertension, palpitations, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Dr. Nicholas Depatche, MD, FACC, author of 4 books and over 100 articles and abstracts at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Who remembers the Philadelphia A's or the Warriors or the old arena at 46th and Market? We do, and that's why the Museum of Sports is being planned for Philadelphia. What's it like to face a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, ride your bike up the Manayunk Wall, or drive in the Pocono 500? We've got rare items from Babe Ruth, Mike Schmidt, Chuck Bednar, Bernie Parent, and Wilt Chamberlain. The Museum of Sports is on the air, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860.
The Ice Capades whirls into its 1949 edition at Atlantic City. There are acres of ice to cool you off and a line of lovelies to warm you right up again.
We're back here on the Museum of Sports show here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. And if you have the option of getting on Facebook Live, we've got a pretty visual segment, the next segment. Of course, the Museum of Sports show brought to you by Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. I'm Doug Scheimel along with Lou Scheinfeld and Susan Baxter. Our next guest, you see him down there in the Zoom box. His grandfather was sort of considered Philadelphia's live entertainment czar in the first half of the 20th century at the old Philadelphia Arena at 46th and Market, promoting celebrity and sports events. He is credited with creating the predecessor to pro basketball and the Icecapades, among many other accolades. Here with some amazing stories of his grandfather is Museum of Sports Show first-timer, Mr. Preston Tyrell. Preston, how are you, man?
I am fine. How are you? Thanks for having me in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I had such fun looking at some of those stills that you had sent over this morning. And before we get to some of those, I want to ask you, we mentioned this pre-show, you know, a lot of times, you know, when you're a kid, you know, and you think of your grandmother and your grandfather as just kind of old people, you don't really understand, you know, kind of what their history has been and sort of what were their claims to fame, you know, might be. When and how did you sort of start piecing together, you know, who grandfather Pete had been in his prime?
I guess when he died, I remember going down to my grandmother's house and she had all the obituaries out. And there were like pictures of him on the table because she was saving them all. And then I was just like, you know, what's this all about? But as they started to have, as I got older and I started to understand things more, I mean, we had Roy Rogers' hat in the front closet and we used to play with that. And my mom would holler at us and I'm like, he owns a hamburger place, you know?
Oh my God.
Yeah, he serves roast beef. What's with the hat? But as I got more into it, you start to understand the sports, and you hear the more stories and you start to put two and two together, I guess, you know, like 10, 12, you started to figure out that it was, you know, things. But these were just regular conversations whenever we got together for, you know, any holiday, they would be talking about these people that were just, you know, to me, it was normal. I didn't know the difference, you know?
That's you hear that a lot from people who have famous parents or grandparents, and it's all the celebs and athletes or whomever that, you know, you had to, they came over to the house and you just thought, you know, they were cutting into your time with your dad or your mom or playtime out back. And then you find out that, you've got a Roy Rogers or, a boxer in there, that sort of thing.
Or Bob Hope.
Or Bob Hope, exactly.
I remember playing pool with Jimmy Karras, who was, you know, hustling me. Of course, I was, you know, 10, and you know, he's doing all these trick shots and I'm like, well, this is neat, you know. And my mom's like, no, this is the guy. But you don't really understand that at the time. It was some guy doing, you know, trick shots.
Preston, you when we chat, thank you so much for reaching out to us, because on behalf of the Museum of Sports, because this is right up our alley, so to speak. But I, as a kid, went to the old arena, 46th Market, took two trolley cars to get there. And my dad took me when I was little, and I saw Roy Rogers there. And we worked our way down to the first row after the show. And he came around on his horse, Trigger. And he had his arm out and the sequined end of his sleeve. I reached out and touched it through the wire. It was a screen there. And I said to my dad, I'm never washing my hand again. So, aww. Of course, my mother had something to say about that when I got home. But my dad took me to see boxing. And I mentioned to you on the phone that we were up in the last row. And the cigar smoke was so thick we couldn't even see the ring. But I saw wrestling there, and I know that, like you said, Bob Hope was there, Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, Victor Borgi, and just it was the place to be. I saw the Ramblers play there once, and I saw a few other games. So it was the place before we built the Spectrum. And Russell Peltz put on boxing there. And I know that Pete Tyrell was a big boxing impresario as well. So he was quite a guy. I'm remiss in never having met him. But I have a lot of respect for him. And some of the photographs that Doug's going to run through here that you supplied us back in the day, I mean, it looks like straight out of The Untouchables.
Yes. He with the boxing, he started in the city of Philadelphia, you only could go 6 rounds. You couldn't go a full 15. So he started a boxing right over the border where he could go 15 rounds. And of course, it didn't take long for the city to realize that they're, you know, missing out on money and revenue. And then the city changed the rules so you could go for 15 rounds of boxing. And then after that, he started at the arena as a publicist, doing the publicity, and went from there. And there is Grandma, Nana and Pop Pop. They weren't Grandma.
So, and I have to ask you, because you have an interesting story behind how your grandfather met your grandmother.
Well, I'm not 100% sure how they met, but my grandmother, or my Nana, as we called her, Grandma was up in Canada. Nana used to work for Boo Boo Hoff, who was a mobster here in Philly, and did tell some stories about meeting Chicago, a.k.a. Al Capone. And he was into boxing and wrestling, and I presume that's how they got together. But I don't know the story of how they met, but wouldn't surprise me if there was some another backstory there that I don't know about.
Now, also, does Boo Boo Hoff's desk exist somewhere in your possession or the family's possession?
Yes, we do have Boo Boo Hoff's desk. I believe it's with my sisters out in Oregon right now. And it was in my living room. It was in my grandma or Nana's room, Nana's house. It was in our living room, and my sisters have it now. And I know one piece broke off, and my father was rather upset about that. But Boo Boo Hoff's desk is still in the family.
How did you come to get that? Did Boo Boo go off to the big house, and some of his possessions came into your possession or your family's possession?
Well, the story is that. Nana was the secretary for Boo Boo Hoff, and some people came in to talk with him.
And sorry.
they were speaking Yiddish as to what they were going to do with his dead body.
Oh, so well, that's lovely.
She went in and informed Boo Boo Hoff, and Boo Boo Hoff sent her out the back door. And when she came back, that was her last day, and Boo Boo Hoff gave her a desk.
Preston, did you go through that desk to see if there's any money hidden in there?
There was no money in there. It's an old, it was an old Oriental desk.
Oh.
So it didn't have a lot of drawers.
Yeah, we're going to ask our king of sports collectibles, Nick DiPaccia Jr., whose family is the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection, what he might think a desk like that would be worth. So you're welcome to hang with us for the first couple of minutes of the next segment. Just because we want to see your expression, namely.
Well, I hope it's not a lot because my sisters have it. I don't.
They better have glued that piece back on. That's all I can say. What is this? Now, this is grandfather on the left. And who's that on the right?
Hold on. I'm going to have to pop in and see the photos. This is the boxing commissioner. And this is a belt that they have. And unfortunately the scan got kind of messed up.
You can still make it out though. That's pretty impressive.
It's a championship belt. Actually, my sister Penny knows more of the boxing because she used to live up in Canastoga, New York, where the Boxing Hall of Fame was. She lived, you know, a half mile away, so used to pop in there all the time. This is another boxer. I think they do have names on them, but I can't get to my...
Looks like someone signing a contract. And you had some wonderful documents on there, which I would love to share for our next show, because you've got some pretty big names in some of those contracts.
Yes, there are some interesting documents downstairs that I have. I also have the take of the gate for the first two seasons of the BBA, how much each game made and what they had to pay out. The documents are neat. Unfortunately, I don't want to take them apart because the staple holding them together is part of the value of the document. So to try to scan them is hard.
Oh, no, 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 no. Yeah, and I think Nick DiPaccio Jr., he would fall over backwards in his chair if you said, I'm going to take the staple out and scan them.
No, I'm smart enough not to take out the staple. But Rich Pagano, who's big into sports, did look at some of the stuff. There is Roy Rogers, obviously. Standing in the back is my father, Nana and Pup Pup, and then Aunt Dodie and Aunt Sis. Aunt Dodie's is still with us. She's out in California, and she, sharp as a tack, you ever want to have a three-hour conversation on Philadelphia arena history, you know, give her a call.
And hopefully that's not the hat that you and your siblings were playing.
No, the hat was a black hat that we
had. Okay, good.
Oh. Yeah. That's a white hat.
It was definitely a white hat. But your grandfather was credited with really sort of mainstreaming these rodeo shows in non-traditional venues like a Philadelphia arena. Typically, the rodeo shows would be down in livestock and rodeo belt, you know, in Texas and the South and the Midwest. But I it seems like Grandpa Pete Tyrell was the one that was credited in, you know, sort of having Roy Rogers succeed, Gene Autry, and getting those before audiences that typically wouldn't go to that stuff.
Yes, and it was him and the other Arena Owners Association. So there was a group of fellow Arena Owners Association up and down the East Coast, and they would start all these traveling shows that would travel from city to city because the money was in the seats, not in the show. And that's how they would do that. You know, they would create the show and away they go. There's Gene Autry, my father and Aunt Dodie, and my grandfather.
You also brought in, you know, your garden variety, or your grandfather also brought in your garden variety celebrities like Bob Hope and Gene Kelly Grace Kelly.
There's Grace Kelly. He lived in Upper Darby, and he would have people out to his house to play pool. He was very big into pool. And I remember as a kid going down there, and on the wall were all these pictures of, you know, very famous people that I recognized, you know, Bob Hope, Dick Clark, Ed McMahon from The Tonight Show. So there were pictures there that I recognized and some people that I didn't. They were all around his wall that would come down there and play pool at his pool table. So that was one of my memories of growing up and visiting. Unfortunately, there was a flood and the pictures got ruined. But
well, Preston, tell us while we still have time about your grandfather's interest in the Philadelphia Eagles.
So this is the Eagles story. So according to my aunt, she has an article that she recently found, and she was my grandfather, Bob Hope, and Roy Rogers were going to, and some other investors were going to buy the Philadelphia Eagles at one point in time. But my grandmother apparently put a stop to it because he had lost too much money on the ice hockey and the basketball, and she didn't want him to lose anymore. So we got rid of the hockey, we got rid of the basketball, we got rid of the football, but we kept the rodeos. So it is what it is, and I go to work every day because of it.
That's interesting that cast of characters would have an interest in buying the Eagles. Was it just because of the availability of it or the low cost? I mean, that's just sort of a weird assemblage of folks who would be interested.
That I don't know. But if they did other investments together, you know, I don't know all the money back in the day, but that's the article that my aunt has that I haven't read yet.
Well, Bob Hope went on to buy a piece of the Pittsburgh Pirates with Bing Crosby.
Did he really? See, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's why I'm on the show.
That's why I'm on the show. He takes all these dinner conversations that I only know this much of, and he strings them together so they make sense.
Hey, I want to share one more screen here, Preston, before we go. And if I, assuming I can do this correctly here, we're going to do that one and we're going to share this. This is one of the home movies, one of the shorter ones that you had sent, but it's just fascinating to watch. And do we know who this is? Is that Grandpa Pete to the left?
Or? I have no idea who those people are, but that was outside the arena at 46th and Market. Right. And I'm presuming this is Aunt Dodie or Aunt Sis down in Atlantic City. At the intro, when you played that, that opening, I do know that he, one of the things that he used to do is for promotion, and I do have pictures of it somewhere, he got big blocks of ice down in the sand in Atlantic City and made a little ice skating rink, you know, 20 by 20, and had the skaters from the Ice Capades perform out on the sand for publicity. So they went out there and they, you know, skated for however long it took for the ice to melt. And that's one of the things that he did when the Ice Capades were down on Atlantic City Convention Hall.
Well, he was a promoter. He was an innovator, a promoter. He had the Warriors before they moved to San Francisco when Eddie Gottlieb owned them. And the Ramblers, the Arrows, hockey teams. What a guy. He should be as well known in Philadelphia as Connie Mack and Ed Snyder and the rest of the visionaries that brought so much entertainment to millions in the Philadelphia region.
Hey, Preston, we've got to go to a break here. Can you hang with us for just a few minutes? I want to introduce you to our King of Sports Collectibles, Nick DePaccia Jr., and I may have you mention one or two of those contracts that you have to see if you can get like a spot appraisal. I always like scaring the hell out of him and whoever happens to have these artifacts. And the Boo Boo Hoff desk. Can you hang with us for 2 seconds?
I can. Actually, I'll run downstairs and I'll get the actual contract so I can...
Oh, fantastic. Well, grandson of legendary Philly sports promoter Pete Tyrell, Preston Tyrell, is going to hang with us through the break. When we come back, our King of Sports Collectibles, who will give Preston a couple of spot appraisals here on some old memorabilia when the Museum of Sports Show continues right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. We'll be right back. You don't want to miss this. Stay with us.
The Museum of Sports Show is presented by DePaccia Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas DePaccia is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat shortness of breath, brain fog, chronic disease, autonomic dysfunction syndrome, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Nicholas DePaccia, MD, FACC, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034. Can you imagine Philadelphia without the Broad Street Bullies or its fabled Spectrum Arena? Well, it almost happened until Lou Scheinfeld and Ed Snyder, otherwise known as Flash and Cash, teamed up to rescue the Flyers and got America's Showplace up and running. It was 1967, and the world was in a whole different place. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's heartfelt memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed copy at themuseumofsports.org. themuseumofsports.org. Blades, Bands, and Ballers, now available.
Who remembers the Philadelphia A's or the Warriors or the old arena at 46th and Market? We do, and that's why the Museum of Sports is being planned for Philadelphia. What's it like to face a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, ride your bike up the Manayunk Wall, or drive in the Pocono 500? We've got rare items from Babe Ruth, Mike Schmidt, Chuck Bednar, Bernie Perron, and Wilt Chamberlain. The Museum of Sports is on the air, and you can join the fun. Every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860.
Hey, buddy, what can I get you? How about the ultimate sports memorabilia basement?
Welcome back to the Museum of Sports Show here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. I'm Doug Scheimel along with Lou Scheinfeld and Susan Baxter. Museum of Sports Show, as always, brought to you by the DePaccia Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. And one of those incredible specialists is right there, our sixth box there in the Zoom box. Up next, our King of Sports Collectibles, whose family has the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection, conservatively estimated at $3,500 billion quintillion dollars, or $35 million, or give or take a couple of hundred million. And he is also our proud partner in the Museum of Sports, Mr. Nick DePaccia Jr. Hiya, Nick.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Hey, we have asked our guest from our previous segment, Preston Tyrell, whose grandfather, Peter Tyrell, was the mastermind of live entertainment and sports promotion in the first half of the 20th century in Philadelphia, mostly at Philadelphia Arena, and was credited with creating the predecessor to the NBA and to the Ice Capades, among many other accolades. Preston was telling us first off that his mother was a secretary for then boxer and Philly mob boss Max Boo Boo Hoff. And when Hoff apparently sort of went away to parts unknown, the desk was given to Pete Tyrell's wife. And it's still in Preston's family. Out with, you said, a sister in Oregon?
It's with my sisters in Oregon, yes.
Nick, off the top of your head, I know furniture isn't your bailiwick, but with kind of an odd little tie-in, like this is an Antiques Roadshow. Well, it is, sort of. what would something like that be worth? Apparently, there were no papers in there, and I don't think Boo Boo was in the desk, or parts of him were not in the desk. Right, Preston?
Best of my knowledge, there is no Boo Boo
Okay, good. Just want to make sure. What, Nick, any idea with the collectability of something like that?
What type of furniture is it? You said it was like a desk,
like an office desk, right, Preston?
It was a desk. It was oriental in nature, so it had some gold leafing around it. I was just quickly trying to find a photo of it, but I don't have one that quick.
I don't. This is just the like off the top of my head what I think it's worth, but this is obviously not something we collect, but I think it would be worth like between 1,000 and 2,500. I don't know. That's like not in my wheelhouse, but that's
Nick loves it when I do this.
Part of it was broken. One of us broke off a little piece of trim at some point.
Oh, now it's really valuable. Yeah.
my dad actually likes like those types of, like, we down at our shore house, we have a lot of oriental furniture, including a desk. So we'll see what he'd be willing to pay with it. I'm going to ask him because I'm curious, because I remember going on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, going into one of those shops that sells stuff like that. And like I said, he came home with a desk. It's a little desk, but I'm going to ask him what he paid for that, because I don't remember. Yeah.
But that wasn't Max Boo Boo Hoff, the mob boss and boxer's desk, Nick. That's what,
no.
So just Max Boo Boo Hoff. Your dad might have heard of him. I know, Preston, you brought up a couple of documents that were somewhat significant. And Nick, let us know what you think these might be worth.
This is an original with the rusty staples still in. I didn't take them out. This is dated 1948. It's a memorandum of agreement between the National Hockey League, the American Hockey League, the United States Hockey League, and the Pacific Coast Hockey League. And it talks with how they're going to move players around and stuff of that nature. My problem is I'm not a sports historian, so when I read this, it doesn't make sense to me because I don't know what they're talking about. So that is.
Can you hold it up, just the cover page, Press? I don't want you to peel that the cover back too far, because I don't want you to damage it.
And the only one of its kind, correct?
It's the, to the best of my knowledge, it is the only one. It is also not signed. So I don't know if this was an idea that went nowhere.
Oh, that could be interesting.
I don't know if this is an extra copy. I don't know of its important significant. Obviously, if, you know, Lou read it and could connect the dots, or somebody, you know, but that,
Preston, first of all, it is one of a kind,
yeah.
And it's never been read, and we're going to sign it. So it's worth a lot.
It's finally going to happen.
Your grandfather would have promoted it a little better than that.
Nick, what was something like that? If it's, assuming it's a one of a kind and is what it appears to be.
Honestly, I think that could go for above 50,000.
Woo! Really?
Yeah. So, and I don't know what the ceiling is, but I think that's the floor. If you get a bidding war going on in an auction, I could see that bringing in big money.
Oh, put that in a nice Ziploc.
I hope my sister's something or other.
Hey, they have the desk.
And they have the desk. They got the desk.
We will accept that as a donation to the museum. Thank you.
10%, Preston. 10%. That's all we ask. And Preston, did you have one more you wanted to show, Nick?
Yeah, here is the accounting spreadsheet from the 1947-48 basketball season. November 13th, they played Providence. The net was 52.89. I guess the city got 548. The feds got 1,000.
Oh, those were the days.
But it goes over each game. And
is that Warriors you're talking about?
I guess it's for the Warriors because they played Providence, Boston, New York, Baltimore, Providence, St. Louis, New York. Yeah. So it has all the games.
It's a Warriors.
November 13th to March 18th.
Hmm. Nick, what do you think on something like that? Looks like it's in good condition.
And it is in condition, yeah. It's not signed by anyone, right? It's not.
Well, it's signed by the accountant.
It's signed by the accountant. I mean, that makes it official. It adds the provenance to it. You get a letter of provenance, too, that that can verify that that's what it is. Those are not hard to obtain. You just need someone with a connection or a historian or someone that's an expert to verify it.
But you can smell the mold from my grandmother's house. It's definitely authentic.
That's another 250 right there. I think
that's probably between 1,000 and 1,500.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah, nah. I think a collector would definitely be interested in that. That's something that would be a nice display piece in even the Naismith Hall of Fame because it's something unique.
Yeah.
And oh, it's wow.
Nicholas, I just got a text from Boo Boo and he said 25,000 or nothing.
Well, we might have to sit down with him and negotiate.
Hey, Preston, I can't thank enough for just hauling those out for is that the old floor plan?
This is the old floor plan for the the first time I've ever seen this because again there's boxes of stuff, you know. It's a seating chart for the arena and it's color coded and the red sections are worth $3. The blue sections are $2.60. The uncolored ones are $1.95.
Definitely not Lou Scheinfeld.
The brown ones are $1.30. So if you want to get the cigar smoke level, it's $1.30 a seat for clean air.
Springsteen doesn't want that to come out.
That's not Scheinfeld pricing, I'll tell you that. Very quickly, Nick, a guesstimate on that?
It's not as much as the other two pieces you had. But it's a few hundred dollars, I would say. Impressive stuff there. And like you said, there's more in the boxes, it sounds like. So you have a lot of treasures in there that I think if you're willing to keep them, they're only going to go up in value. But you could probably get a good payday out of some of them.
And in all honesty, I'm really not looking for a good payday. I mean, if this is a very historic document and needs to be somewhere, then that's where it needs to be. It doesn't need to be in my basement. It needs to be.
We'll pick it up tomorrow.
Yeah. We'll send a U-Haul by. Yeah, Preston, you know, maybe spend a few minutes now and then culling through what you have. Pull some things that catch your eye. Let us know, and we'll have you back on, and maybe we'll do a more extended segment with you. Preston Terrell. Go ahead. Preston,
yes.
That on here.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said, of all the guests we've had on here, you have one of the more impressive finds in terms of uniqueness and I think like a lot of that that you're going to find is going to be pieces that are historically significant, which I mean those it's even putting a value on it, like you said, it deserves to be in a place where the public can see it. Right. Even if you loan it out there it's still, it would say loaned by Preston Tyrell. So, well, I mean, we'd be happy at our museum and put a sign up that says on loan by Preston Tyrell.
There is, my father did donate a lot of stuff to the Atwater Kent Museum. So that's where Roy Rogers' hat is. He had a complete set of tickets for the first season of the BBA or NBA from all the teams. That is down there. So there's my father went giving stuff away at one point in time. A lot of it's down at the Atwater Kent Museum.
Well, Preston, take some time, cull through that box, let us know, and we'll have you back on. Thanks for hanging with us for a little extra.
Not a problem. Over now.
Hey, Nick, we've only got about, as usual, we're a little short on time. You went to the National Card and Collection Show in Atlantic City. How was it? Was it a bellwether for good collectible times or bad collectible times?
Well, before I answer that, I just got an alert literally this second from the ESPN app. It says rare T206 Honus Wagner baseball card sells for $7.25 million.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Dot, dot, dot.
Well, that's a good sign.
And breaking news, you can only hear on the Museum of Sports show.
I'll tell you what, and we can call it breaking news on the Museum of Sports show.
I know you were saying that you
were looking to see what the crowd was going to be like, and that was kind of an indicator of where the market is.
Yeah, the National, it was packed. There were hundreds of booths with vendors, and all the big card companies were there. PSA was there. Beckett was there for authentication. Fanatics had a booth there. I don't think that this is being affected by the recession. Let's put it that way. I think people are still willing to spend on sports memorabilia at the current moment.
And if that Honus Wagner sale you just mentioned in breaking news is an indicator, it's alive and well.
Yeah, I don't think every piece will get $7.25 million, but yeah, it's alive and well, like you said.
Well, I'll tell you what, kids, we are out of time for this week. Our big thanks to our King of Sports Collectibles, Nick DiPaccio Jr. Thanks for letting us throw those sudden appraisals in your face, but that could be significant, depending upon what he could find. That could be huge.
Yeah, it's very impressive, and you could fill a whole show up with whatever else he finds in the box.
Right. Well, then I think that's what we'll do. And Lou, let us know if he gets back in touch, and then we can set up a good segment of the show for just Nick and he to sit back.
I'm looking for one of Boo Boo's fingers.
Remember, Boo Boo Hoff. No, Max Boo Boo Hoff. Tell your dad that. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our guest, Temple Hall of Famer Bill Bradshaw, Pete Tyrell's grandson, Preston Tyrell, and of course, our King of Sports Collectibles, Nick DiPaccio Jr. And don't forget to buy Lou's new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. Get your custom autographed copy today by going to themuseumofsports.org, and Lou will color it with his sharpest crayon. Also available anywhere fine literature is sold, and a portion of the proceeds benefit the Museum of Sports. Museum of Sports show brought to you by the DiPaccio Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. For Lou Scheinfeld, Susan Baxter, and Nick DiPaccio Jr., I'm Doug Scheimel, reminding you of what our good friend Carly Simon always says, Lou.
These are the good old days.
They are indeed. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you back here next week.